Great. Let me thank the organizers for the chance to speak here. The difference in title, I decided to focus it a bit more because I realized from the earlier talks today that if I didn't give at least a few details, I would get some trouble from the audience. So it's going to be focused on Weil and Dirac semi-metals as the main application. Whether you make those in a solid or in an optical lattice depends on which of the effects you're looking for. We actually were led to that problem by thinking about something completely different that in the end we didn't resolve, but we realized that by accident we were really working about something much trendier than what we thought we were working about. So that was good. So this is work with a lot of people, several of whom are here, and I'll mention the papers as I go along. So this is the first result. This is maybe to motivate why do we have to go to nonlinear effects for the point of this talk. So I want to start off with what sounds like a negative result. So if you take a Weil or Dirac semi-metal of the kind we have now, which are the kind that respect time reversal symmetry, and ask, is there an interesting or topological, let's say, electromagnetic response in the bulk, I want to convince you that the answer is no. The so-called chiral magnetic effect in linear response does not exist. And actually here there's a history the last couple of years in condensed matter that is basically repeating a history in particle theory about 5 years before then. There is a linear response effect, which I find quite interesting. We called it the gyrotropic magnetic effect, but it's not all that topological. But that's kind of a warm-up of why we need to go eventually to more than one field beyond linear response. So I will advertise briefly some work on strong magnetic fields and chiral pumping, so how you can get a positive result for chiral pumping or the chiral anomaly. But I was pretty tangentially involved in this work, so I'd encourage you to ask either Mike or Adolfo, who are both here. And then the question I want to kind of build up to is our answer to the question, what is quantized in Weil semimetals? So I said nothing was quantized at linear response. That means something is quantized maybe at a higher order. And we have an effect. It's actually an old effect in solids, but there was never any other case, as far as I know, where it's quantized, which is called the chiral photogalvanic effect. I'll explain what that is, and we think that is quantized with an unusual-looking quantum in some class of Weil semimetals. So that will be the end. So first, and I apologize for going quickly, but I think most of you have heard this kind of thing before somewhere, so I had baryphases in the title. When we're thinking about, say, electrons in a solid or atoms moving in an optical lattice, then crystal momentum is like a parameter space in the sense of baryphase. To be more explicit, if I think about block wave functions and take the periodic part, then I can use that to make a connection, a vector potential that lives in parameter space. So we know just like in E and M, A itself at one particular point in K space is not going to be observable, but its curl is, and we sometimes call this the Berry curvature. So it turns out we find a lot of physical quantities, and I have a list, I think, on the next slide, that are governed by A and F. Most of the low energy properties of solids that are not just determined by the band structure E of K come out of A and F and things related to them. And the first of those, which was recognized by part of this year's Nobel Prize, was the one that appears in the integer quantum Hall effect, where if you calculate, just doing second-order perturbation theory in the Kubo formula, how much do band electrons contribute to the Hall effect, you get a formula that at first glance looks complicated, but then you realize that this is just the integral of F, so what appears in the parentheses here is just F over the whole Brillouin zone. And like in other cases, when you integrate something that has a local geometric meaning like a curvature over a whole closed manifold, you can get something topological, and that's indeed what happens. So this topological number, the so-called TKNN integer, where T is thouless, tells you how much does that band, if occupied, contribute to the Hall effect. So in a way, this calculation consists of nothing very technical, or at least nothing that requires field theory or anything like that. It's second-order perturbation theory organized in a way that the geometry kind of comes out, and that's actually the spirit of some of the calculations later in the talk as well. So I claim that everything natural that you can make out of the Berry connection and Berry curvature seems to mean something. And that's been kind of a 30-year program in condensed matter physics. So the integer quantum Hall effect was the first example. These are topological phases with no symmetry. When you add symmetry, then two examples are the 2D and 3D Z2 topological insulators. And beautiful work generalizes all this to many more phases, as you've probably heard. For this talk, I'm going to focus on a couple of other things. So one is, even if you don't have symmetry and you don't have quantization, there are Berry-phase expressions that are meaningful and quite important. The oldest of those is just the electrical polarization. The polarization of a solid is something that people thought about for 50 years or so before finally getting the right answer, which really depended on the Berry-phase idea. And then the magnetoelectric effect, that's what I'm going to use as my warm-up, because that's an example of an effect that's second order in applied field. It's order EB, electric field times magnetic field. And then the focus of this talk is on phenomena in metals, gapless systems. So there are old effects in metals that do involve the Berry phase but are not quantized. And I'll say a little bit about those and then come up to one that is quantized. And in the process, I'll explain what that figure is about. Okay, so first example. So now let's think about insulators, because insulators, it's relatively easy to see why topological things might happen. So let me discuss 3D topological insulators from the point of view of a particle physicist, because actually in the 1980s, they had more or less written down the effective action induced by a 3D topological insulator. For example, there's a paper by Wilczek that was certainly ahead of its time, which is on the idea, well, we know if we go in a solid, we can modify the effective electromagnetic Lagrangian. One particular term that we would expect to induce in some low symmetry situations is a term like E dot B. Which is a little bit special because it's a total derivative. It's the total derivative of ADA, the electromagnetic Chern-Simons term, which we know has something to do with the quantum Hall response. So the main point in this Wilczek paper is that, okay, we know that this would be allowed if we broke time reversal symmetry and we broke inversion symmetry, because then having something linear in E and linear in B is natural. But actually, even if you have time reversal symmetry, what that does is effectively quantize theta to one of two possible values, zero or pi. Because if you believe that theta is an angle, so that theta is equivalent to theta plus 2 pi n, then under an operation that flips theta, such as time reversal, well, zero is equal to minus zero, but pi is also equal to minus pi. And those are sort of the two inequivalent possibilities. So that's allowed. And let me give a picture for what that means in topological insulators and then say how that's kind of part of the full theory. So the way that connects to the definition you've probably heard before of what is a 3D topological insulator, which is it's a material that has an odd number of Dirac cones on the surfaces and has time reversal symmetry, is the following. If you take your 3D topological insulator and you apply a weak T-breaking field that is weak in the sense of not modifying the insulating bulk but puts the surfaces into a gap state, then on the surfaces, because there are an odd number of Dirac cones or odd number of Fermi surface sheets, you don't see the integer Hall effect, you see the half-integer Hall effect. And if you've got surfaces with a half-integer Hall effect, then through the magic of high school calculus, that is exactly the same thing as a bulk theta equal to pi. Because to say that there's a half-integer Hall effect on the surfaces, that's saying you have electromagnetic ADA with a certain coefficient. And if that's resulting from a change in theta between the bulk and the outside, then you can transform that to simply a term like this in the bulk. So that was a little quick, but I did that because I think you've probably heard it before. So this is, if you want a nonlinear response in the sense I had to apply both something to break time reversal at the surfaces and then an electric field or something like that and measure B. Another way to look at it is it's a term of order EB in the action. So we'd like to find interesting things in metals. They're a little bit similar. But first, let me write down the sort of topological aspect of this. And it's more evidence for the claim that everything natural you can make out of A and F has to mean something. And then talk about how this is a piece of the full theory. So if you take what I just said, it's that there's a topological part of magnetoelectric response. And there are different ways you could measure it. Where that comes from microscopically, if you take the Berry connection, so I'm writing script A for the Berry gauge fields, which actually are non-abelian for this to work, and Roman A is the electromagnetic field. If I take the integral of a certain object made out of the non-abelian Berry phase, which is called the Chern-Simons form, then that gives me a way of writing theta compactly. So there is a nice Berry phase gauge term that measures the magnetoelectric effect. That's actually a piece and maybe a clue to how the full theory has to work for magnetoelectricity in any material. So if you take any three-dimensional insulator, forget about topological or not, and ask what is its magnetoelectric response, there's always a piece, which is that Chern-Simons form of the Berry connection. And then there's a part which you could sort of think of as ordinary. Ordinary in that you can write it to make it look like electric dipole moment, magnetic dipole moment, energy denominator. So this is certainly very non-geometric. It's got energies, it's got off-diagonal parts, and so on, but there's one pure scalar geometric part. And in general, those are not really separate unless you add some extra symmetry, like what happens in topological insulators, where this gets quantized and this is zero by symmetry. So we want to take maybe lessons learned from all this and now move on to metals. And maybe a warm-up for what is the Berry phase going to mean in metals and how you can understand most of the old-fashioned effects, the non-quantized ones, is it tells you something about where the electron sits in real space. And the easiest way to see that is electrical polarization. So electrical polarization in a solid is just the integral of A. This is writing out what the Berry connection is. And electric polarization is certainly about where the electron, well, to be precise, changes in polarization are about changes in where the electron sits within the unit cell, because those give me currents through the unit cell. Polarization isn't quantized unless I add a symmetry, but it's a nice physical observable that involves the Berry phase. In fact, that complicated E dot B thing I just talked about, you can view as generalizing polarization to two dimensions higher. And if you want sort of a general reason, and this is a clue that we have used a couple times to find effects that might involve the Berry phase, the reason why polarization, it was a logical guess that it should involve the Berry phase, is if you just look at the band structure E of K, that is the energy as a function of momentum, and if you have time reversal symmetry, then E of K is equal to E of minus K, even if you break inversion. Time reversal effectively forces the band structure to be symmetric, even if the material is not. And that means that any physical quantity that is sensitive to the fact that the material broke that symmetry can't just come from E of K, it has to come from the wave functions. And the simplest thing, we'll see, not the only thing, but the simplest thing to make out of the wave functions at low energy is the Berry phase. So the simplest effects that come from Berry phases in metals, and even some of the not simple ones, you can go back and understand them in terms of this equation, which is sometimes cited as the biggest omission in, say, Ashcroft and Merman, the classic solid state book. So the first term is there. This is just the group velocity. It's saying that E of K modifies the velocity of an electron. The second term is the one that comes from the Berry curvature. It's called the anomalous velocity. So F is the same Berry curvature I talked about a moment before. And the reason why it's there is that suppose that the electron sits in one part of the unit cell, say atom A at 1K, and on atom B at another K. Then if K is changing, in addition to the ordinary velocity, there's effectively a velocity within the unit cell because the center of the electron's position is changing. And that's an extra effect that needs to be included. And Karplus and Luttinger said these words a long time ago, but no one really understood them very well until it was reinterpreted as a Berry phase by people like Sundaram and New. So that's enough to understand a couple of effects in ordinary metals. It turns out that there are cases where you can't quite understand it semi-classically, and you can get something quantized. Most of the things that come out of this are not quantized, and I'll give one very old example and then one new one. So the original example of what we believe to have a Berry phase part in metals is the anomalous Hall conductivity. So Hall measured this back in the old days. The idea is if you take a material like iron that's already magnetic and measure its Hall effect, you don't need to apply a B field. It's got a Hall effect, and there's a piece of that that is independent of impurities and some other Fermi surface details. It's basically the same integral that Thouless et al. Wrote down, except instead of going over the whole Brillouin zone, I only go over the occupied Fermi Sea. So there are other contributions as well, and it's quite difficult to split off the so-called intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. The problem is that basically it's believed to dominate in a region of sort of intermediate conductivity or intermediate coupling, but it's there, it's a real effect, but there's no natural way to quantize it, or more precisely, if you quantize it, you just get back to the ordinary Hall effect, the quantum Hall effect. So the two other effects that are going to come up in the rest of this talk, the first one I'll say more about later. It's a nonlinear optical effect that involves the Berry phase, and it's been observed for a long time, and looking back at all those experiments, maybe 15 years of experiments, we think they're consistent with it being predominantly determined by the Berry phase. So we and another group realized that around the same time. And the effect is the following, and I'm going to say a lot more about this later. It's that it's a photocurrent, which means a current linear in intensity, so that's second order in applied field. And it's the piece of photocurrent that is one way for right circular light and then the other way for left circular light, so the switchable part of photocurrent. And you can get that just from that semi-classical equation I wrote down and by drawing pictures and moving your hands around like this one. So maybe I'll come back to that later. Well, let me do it now, just in case I forget to do it later. So if I took just ordinary semi-classical transport in a metal, then the effect of the electric field is to push the electrons a little bit away from the ground state, which is the black circle, into, say, the gray circle. So if I now have the light be circularly polarized, this circle kind of rotates around, and the ordinary velocity averages to zero. If I have the right sort of material, like a quantum well that has time reversal but breaks inversion symmetry, then the anomalous part doesn't cancel out. Basically, if there's a Berry phase part that's linear in kx, say, then when I've deflected the electrons a little bit, I get a non-zero Berry phase and a non-zero dkdt, and by the time I'm back around to the other side, both of those have flipped. So the anomalous velocity doesn't average out, while the ordinary velocity does. That's why this is a Berry phase effect. So that doesn't sound, maybe it sounds, I guess, believable, but not that profound. Let me come back to it a bit later, because it turns out to behave a lot differently in some wild semi-metals. Then what got us into this game of wild semi-metals was actually a question that had nothing to do with them. It was thinking about a linear optics question that has kind of a long history, which is, if you take a material that is non-magnetic but has low spatial symmetry, and quartz is the most famous example, if you pass light through quartz, it rotates the polarization of the light. It's like the Faraday effect in a magnet. It's called natural optical activity in materials that don't break time reversal. So is there a geometric meaning to natural optical activity at low frequency? That's kind of what got us interested. So we were interested in that just to try to understand natural optical activity. So lots of chiral materials like quartz, if you take sugar water with chiral sugars, you get the same effect. So how does that happen is what got us interested. And we were interested by the cuprates, which used to be trendy, but maybe no longer are. And then the surprise in doing that, you develop a theory and you realize that what you're studying, and this is the more recent paper, what we were studying without even knowing it was the chiral magnetic effect in wild semimetals, which is certainly a topical subject. So I want to explain how those are unexpectedly connected. And first of all, the chiral magnetic effect is either zero in one limit, which is not that exciting, or in another limit, it's non-zero, but it is not really the chiral magnetic effect. It doesn't have anything to do with the chiral anomaly and so on. So what is it? Let me get up to that. So briefly, just for your general knowledge, the reason why we cared was there's a very confusing experiment in high-temperature superconductivity. So probably the biggest news in the high-TC phase diagram since I was in grad school is that a lot of things onset in this kind of range. Maybe the clearest signal is X-ray scattering, showing that the X-ray diffraction, showing that there's some kind of charge ordering set. And now other things see that as well, and they're all consistent with one kind of symmetry breaking, except for an experiment at Stanford using optics, which onsets at the same place but requires a different symmetry breaking. Basically, what the Stanford measurement measures, and this is Aaron Kapitolnik's group, is that if you bounce light off a cuprate and measure the Kerr effect, you find that the light rotates. And that, the basic sort of problem, is that that requires breaking time reversal symmetry. If you had any kind of charge order that didn't break time reversal symmetry, then all the other experiments could be explained, but you couldn't explain this Sagnac interferometer, at least unless it's unexpectedly nonlinear or something weird like that. So that was the puzzle we wanted to understand, and we didn't totally understand it. But in the process of doing it, at least we still don't know how to reconcile that experiment with all the others. But basically, we rediscovered a classic old piece of work by Halperin, which is that if you have time reversal symmetry, you can't get that Kerr effect. You can only get the Faraday effect, or the equivalent of the Faraday effect, which is this optical activity. So that's why we got interested in optical activity, to try to understand the microscopics of what was happening in that Kapitolnik experiment. So we realized that it's probably a Berry phase effect, or something like a Berry phase effect. What that means, I'll come to. And we wanted to see how, Halperin has to be right on some macroscopic Onsager relation-like level, and how does that happen microscopically? It comes about from a neat topological identity that is also why there is no chiral magnetic effect statically in wild semimetals. So how are these things connected? Well, The chiral magnetic effect, just to define terms, is the idea that if I put on a magnetic field and no electric field, I get a current. And everyone, I think, agrees that this is zero at equilibrium. In other words, if you let a system reach equilibrium in the magnetic field, there are no macroscopic currents. It is true that you can get a non-zero current of this type in what's sometimes called the transport limit, which is still linear response, but it's the different order of Q goes to zero and omega goes to zero. So equilibrium means first omega goes to zero, then Q goes to zero. It's like the compressibility in the electrical case. Transport is the other limit. It's like the conductivity in the electrical case. And what you wind up with is not the Berry phase. It's another thing also made of the low energy wave functions, but basically this is a tensorial response that has nothing to do with the chiral anomaly, so we called it gyrotropic magnetic effect. It's actually controlled by the block moment, the orbital moment of block electrons, and I'll write down what that is in a second. And I'm going to go a little bit quickly because linear response, we're basically saying a negative result from the topological point of view, although I think the physics is kind of interesting. So let me go on to wild semimetals as an example where all of these things become particularly simple. So one big area of condensed matter right now is two ways of cutting the Dirac equation in half. One way is the way that Weil did, which is if you have massless particles, you can take Dirac's 4x4 matrix equation and simplify it into left-handed and right-handed 2x2 pieces. There's another simplification by Majorana that's also topical, but let's focus on Weil's for this talk. So the way this works in a three-dimensional solid using our topological language is that, and this idea I think has some history, if you take a Weil point, which is a two-band linear crossing, I'm not going to talk about type 2s, then around one of these points you can draw a little sphere and compute the churn number, and you'll get some integer. And in general, there'll be some set of these points, and the total churn number is zero. That's the only thing that's forced on you by Nielsen Ninomiya. There are interesting surface effects, as pointed out in this classic paper. So focusing on the bulk for now, what are the consequences of this topological nature of the Weil points? So what is the chiral anomaly that people talked about as maybe the most interesting thing to look for now that we have Weil semimetals? And the idea, it's again an E dot B effect, that basically if you have a single Weil fermion, its current is not conserved, that's the anomaly aspect, once I put on parallel E and B fields. So in our condensed matter idea, we've got overall zero Weil charge. The idea of the chiral magnetic effect was that rather than having to work with two fields, if you could put two Weil points at different energies, which does happen, that's allowed if you have a low symmetry material, basically a material without too many mirror symmetries, then the hope was that that chemical potential difference could replicate the electric field in the chiral anomaly, and you would get a current that was just linear in B. And if you work through the details of that, this is the topological identity I was talking about. You can actually see this happening even in semi-classics, how it vanishes, but you have to be careful. You find that there are three pieces that contribute to the static current in a B field. You add them all up. Here, omega is what I called F before. It's the Berry curvature. V is the group velocity. I add them all up, and at the end of the day, I get zero. So I realize I'm a little bit behind schedule, so this is going to flash by. That's the quantum mechanical proof of it, so I wasn't planning to read that to you. There is a non-zero linear effect, and that's the transport limit. So that we studied a lot to try to figure out what it is, and the main thing is you realize that it comes not from the chiral anomaly, not from the Berry phase, but from the orbital moment of block electrons, and it's actually an old experiment, which is this optical rotation. So the way that the orbital moment matters is yet another correction to the semi-classic. So that page I showed you was our full Kubo formula derivation, which is actually the first thing we did, and then we reinterpreted it semi-classically. Basically, what's going on is that the group velocity is also not exactly what it's said to be in Ashcroft and Merman, at least I don't think so. You've got an extra piece, which is a k-dependent orbital magnetic moment of the electron dotted into B. The gradient of this gives you an extra piece of velocity. And if you look at how this might have been missed or how it's related to the Berry phase, it's exactly like the Berry phase, except it's got an extra power of energy in it. And if you are near enough to a Weil point, it actually is the Berry phase times some constant factor. So it's easy to confuse with the Berry phase, but it's actually not the same thing. And the linear response chiral magnetic effect, so-called, is actually optical rotation, also called gyrotropy. So that's why, to be pedantic, we renamed it the gyrotropic magnetic effect. So that was all the linear case. This is kind of the summary. So if we go to state, you know, what is the punchline as far as interesting effects? This is saying that if you had vowel nodes split by E, then the linear response, even if you looked at the optical rotation, even if you looked at the right effect, you get an effect that looks so like something not very universal. It involves the energy difference. It's not quantized or topological. And there are cases where you can get quantized responses, but you have to work either out of equilibrium or go to second order. And the first thing I was going to show, and this is one I wanted to advertise, is this work by those people, and as I said, Mike and Adolfo are here, which is on if you take a vial semimetal in 3D and try to imitate what Hofstadter did in 2D, you can draw some really pretty pictures, and you can get some physics out. In particular, you can actually see the pumping happening. So this is how you can actually construct a pumping experiment, and this was motivated in part by the possibility of doing this kind of thing in optical lattices. So you can get what we call vial butterfly, like Hofstadter butterfly, but better because it's 3D. And this is maybe the more physics part of it, aside from the pretty pictures. You can get pumping where at every, when you hit certain commensurate fluxes, new vial nodes appear. Vial nodes give you an extra contribution to the chiral anomaly, and that shows up in the kind of numerical pumping experiment. So these different slopes correspond to different values of the chiral anomaly. And now with that, in my last 5 minutes or so, I want to get to the punchline. So first, you might say, if you were really used to topological stuff, that there's no way anything can be exponentially quantized in a gapless system. And I think that's true. But things can be quantized in a sense that's sort of good enough for government work. And the classical example of that is graphene. And this is one of the coolest experiments in graphene. And it doesn't require a lot of high-tech stuff. If you take a sheet of graphene, it attenuates one layer of graphene, I should say, attenuates 2.3% of light. That number 2.3% is pi times the fine structure constant, pi times 1 over 137. And it's at about that accuracy. It's not 1 over 137.06 dot, 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 dot. It's, you know, within one part in 100 or so, this is a valid quantized result in a metal. I don't know that it's particularly topological. I think of it as a consequence of linear spectrum, really. But stuff like that is what we'd like to find, and in particular in vial semimetals. Because now that we've said that we don't really think the chiral magnetic effect is quantized or topological, if you go to E dot B and other measurements, unless you're careful, like in this pumping paper, you get lots of other effects as well. So what can you get? So this is the picture I drew before. This is the effect we think is quantized. So Joe Orenstein and I studied this effect semi-classically when it's not quantized, but it's the same physical effect, it's just a different system. So the semi-classical effect is the one I just described. You get a non-zero average of the anomalous velocity if you have a Berry phase that is linear in K, say, which is the first power that's allowed in breaking symmetry. Okay, so this is the experimental data that I mentioned. So there's several papers like this from Ganachev, and to their credit, they had an explanation based on spin orbit coupling, and then they did the experiment in various materials and realized that it didn't really care what the strength of the spin orbit coupling was. That's a sign it had to be something else, and we think it's the Berry phase. And Liang Fu and Inti Soderman recently gave a generalization of this all to higher dimensions and so on. So what I want to focus on now is what happens in a vial semimetal, where I have low symmetries so that the vial points are different energies. And now I have to calculate. Now I can't get away with semi-classics, basically, because I'm interested in frequencies where at this vial node, I'm so-called polyblocked. There are electrons. So this difference is the frequency. Polyblocking means if I've already got electrons here, I won't get transitions from here to there. So I'm shutting off the vial nodes that are below the Fermi surface by polyblocking. I will have other vial nodes, like this one, say, where that transition is allowed. So I should go, and now there's no easy way. I have to go and do the fully quantum mechanical calculation and figure out what is the strength of optical effects at second order from this vial node, and is there anything interesting there? So all of this is maybe saying that it's more like the graphene case than it is like the quantum Hall effect, in that there are other contributions. So for example, there's a contribution from here, but that's the ordinary semi-classical metallic contribution, and we know how small that is. So it turns out that there's an effect which, first of all, is about 100 times larger from the vowel point. Second, and more interesting, it's actually quantized. So by quantized, what I mean is the following. The current that is produced, and in particular, the piece of the current that depends on the sense of polarization, so this thing, the difference between induced current right circular and induced current left circular, is proportional to intensity times wild charge times, it's a nonlinear optical effect, so we can't use our old friend E squared over H. Instead, it's E cubed over H squared C. But that's the universal coefficient. Note that there is nothing material dependent in the quantum. So that's the quantum of the quantized CPGE that is there if you have wild semimetals with low spatial symmetry. So that all sounds great. The only problem is at the moment in the laboratory, all the wild semimetals we have mirror symmetries. There are a couple that are being grown that we think will work, like strontium silicide. But for example, the tantalum arsenide family is the one everyone works with. Those have 24 wild nodes related by a bunch of mirror symmetries. So this effect will be zero because there are just not enough symmetries to allow the CPGE. So if you wonder how large is this effect, you know, should you go build a solar cell out of it because it is a photocurrent? Well, if you take a world-class terahertz fairly intense laser and shine it and put 1 watt in, you will get a few nanoamps out, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's, as I said, under the conditions we did the calculation, it's close to 100 times larger than the standard circular photogalvanic effect. So it's large enough to know that you're seeing what you think you're seeing, we hope, but not large enough that you need to rush out and buy stock. So just to kind of wrap up, as I said, there are a lot of, even aside from the one I focused on, which is the circular photogalvanic effect, tantalum arsenide is very polar. It strongly breaks inversion. It just has too many other symmetries as well. But there are some other interesting effects that can happen because of that. There's a paper with Daniel Varyash, his first author, that if you're interested in just polar metals and what they can do, I would encourage you to read. The basic idea is that even in a metal, there's a sense in which changes in polarization are well-defined, and that enables a whole bunch of effects. So to wrap up, I have my outline slide, except now I called it conclusions, so I won't read it to you again. Thanks. Anton.
What about the order?
Well, so it depends on which effect. So first of all, the linear effect, the gyrotropic magnetic effect will cut off. So I've only thought about disorder at the level of a relaxation time. So if you go to a frequency that is lower than an inverse relaxation time, that effect will turn off. The other one, you're slightly saved because you're already at non-zero frequency for this to work. You might ask, well, where is frequency in this equation? Well, we've assumed we're in a range of frequencies where we're getting the metallic contribution here because the vowel contribution is polyblocked. So I think at the range of frequencies we're talking about, you don't need a particularly clean material. I mean, as far as I can tell, for one effect, I know this is true, for the linear effect. For the nonlinear effect, we have not, to be honest, gone back and redone the diagrams with disorder. But I think omega tau is the only factor that matters in a simple picture of disorder. And here, this is not deep in the low frequency limit. So for example, I would expect that this experiment should be done in terahertz or infrared. And at least infrared, it's not that hard to make a clean sample that looks clean in the infrared timescale.
About the polarization of light, let's say, by sugar or quartz. So could you say a bit more how that's related? Is that the periphase effect?
Yeah, so this is what in our first paper, we did a simple example. In that simple example, we thought it was the periphase, but it's actually this thing. It's the orbital moment. So let me find the formula for the answer and then go back to this. So this is the answer, basically. So first of all, if you're at high frequency, I don't know how to write simple formulas at high frequency. They just look like complicated perturbation theory or diagrammatic expressions. But the low frequency limit is very nice. So one reason you might expect that, most low frequency things in metals are ultimately Fermi surface properties. Maybe that's not strictly true. You could think about Landau diamagnetism or something. But at least most things are Fermi surface properties. So you can ask, if I take a metal and at low frequency it rotates light, so quartz is an insulator. Let me come back to that. But if I take a metal and it rotates light at low frequency, then the property on the Fermi surface that matters, this is the integral of the Fermi surface of Fermi velocity and orbital magnetic moment. So it's basically saying that you should think about the orbital moment on the Fermi surface as an ingredient to put into Fermi-liquid theory, which maybe we don't always think about, but it's kind of obvious in hindsight it should be there. So then quartz, we thought that now that we understand the low frequency limit, we'll be able to go back to these old papers by people like Wilkins that have, you know, five-line formulas for all the contributions in quartz and say, aha, this is the Berry curvature, this is the orbital moment, and so and so. And after about 6 months of trying to do that, we gave up. So once you go to high frequency in a material with symmetry as low as quartz, I suspect that there ought in principle to be some way that you could organize that into pieces that are geometrically meaningful, but we haven't succeeded. And this was Shudan Zhang, Felix Flicker, and me. So it could be done if someone wants to try, but we have not yet succeeded.
Thinking about the collatoms implementation, here you have J current that is depending of B, and you are changing the E by a bias, by different energy. Can be the opposite case, that you can do something that takes the role of B and have something J as a function of E?
I would think so. I would think that, Yeah, just to maybe back up one step. So here, the way that I wrote this as an effect linear in B, but the way it's observed is actually an electromagnetic wave. So to be precise, the reason why we called it gyrotropic magnetic effect, if you think about the transport limit of a B field, that means Q goes to zero first, then omega goes to zero. So B is oscillating, but you can't really have an oscillating B without an electric field. So you wind up basically describing an electromagnetic wave. That's why the transport limit of the chiral magnetic effect is exactly the same as the response to an electromagnetic wave in linear order. So yeah, what you're asking is, now if I think about getting farther away from equilibrium by perturbing, say, yeah, what I talked about is if I got away from equilibrium by putting different nodes at different chemical potentials, there would be a linear B effect. It's certainly true. I guess a simple example would be if I have a material where B exists already. I mean, the equivalent of applying B would be like going to a magnetic material. If I go to a magnetic material, then that certainly enables linear and E effects that weren't there before, like the Hall effect. So I think that would be like saying if you took an optical lattice or something, that's just not allowed to have a sigma XY in linear response unless you break time reversal. But if you had a way to break time reversal, which would be like effectively applying an artificial B, then that would allow the effect. Yeah. So the simplest example would be the Hall effect, but there are others. I mean, in this talk, I focused on the time reversal invariant effects, but the Hall, yeah, I suspect that it's true not just for the Hall effect, but for the other effects that require time reversal. From a symmetry point of view, it doesn't usually matter whether it was like an orbital magnetic field or whether it was any other T-breaking perturbation. So I think most of those should become allowed as soon as you break T.
Other questions? Going once? Okay, if not, let's thank Joel again.